Mark has been a pioneer for mindfulness for many years, starting the Oxford Mindfulness Centre. His work has inspired many, helped people through dark times, and has certainly helped people redirect their lives towards a better place. On a Trust Me, I'm a Doctor with Michael Mosley, groups try to improve their stress levels by doing gardening or yoga or mindfulness or nothing. And the group that had the most reduced stress after the test period was the mindfulness group. So we've got to learn from this, because remember, we with Parkinson's suffer anxiety. You know those times when you get somewhere and you go, where's the loo? Or you get to the train station as I did and the train had been cancelled. I went into total panic. So anxiety is a big issue for people with Parkinson's. So welcome, Mark. We welcome you to give us some insight into mindfulness. Thank you.
Thank you, Sally. Well, it's a delight for me to be here. Thank you very much for asking me to come and to say a few words about mindfulness. And I aim to speak for about half an hour, but we might do a meditation in that half an hour. And if we do a meditation, then it might be slightly over half an hour. So if that's okay, let's begin. What I want to cover is really what mindfulness is, and then why it's needed, how it works, is it effective, and really, why have people got so enthusiastic about it in the culture? It seems to have escaped the laboratory and the clinic, despite our attempts to be very cautious about our claims for what mindfulness can do and the evidence base that's out there, and it's in the NICE guidelines for as a treatment for preventing depression now. But there was a while when the press seemed to really go for mindfulness in a big way. So you couldn't open a newspaper or a magazine without it being recommended for everything. Nothing is good for everything. And then there was a backlash, and you couldn't open a newspaper without people saying mindfulness is bad for your health. And hopefully that will all settle down one day and the press will lose interest, and we can just get back to doing the research and putting it out there and seeing where it's most of benefit for people. So I want to give a little bit of the history of mindfulness in explaining what it is and then how it's used. So mindfulness itself, the word, is a modern translation of an old word that originated in Sanskrit, but it was the Pali word. Pali is a form of Sanskrit, which was the language that the early Buddhist texts were written down. And the word, it was sati. Sati came from a word originally meaning memory. So sati came to mean non-forgetfulness, a sense of awareness. So it moved from just being about memory to being about awareness. It was memory in the sense in which if you say to a child in church, remember where you are, you're not actually asking the child to remember anything, in a sense. You're asking them to be aware of where they are. So it's memory in that sense, the sense of awareness. So mindfulness is really about having an awareness of what's going on with you, what's going on in your mind, and what's going on, and in what's going on in your body, but also what's going on in the outside world, sort of moment by moment, and seeing if you can become aware of this without harsh self-judgment, without being too critical about yourself and indeed about other people or other things. So this direct intuitive awareness is what mindfulness refers to. Now, we all have times when we're more mindful, I think, than other times when we're a bit mindless. We know mindlessness, I think, very well. We know how distracted we can be. And mindfulness starts by reminding people and training people how to pay attention, sort of like training the attentional muscle, as it were, how to pay focused attention in the face of lots of distractions, how to stay on the same thing for as long as you want to stay on it, rather than be distracted all the time and have your mind go this way and that. So that's really the first thing that's learnt in mindfulness. And because we all know that sometimes we can feel very centered and other times very distracted, we can see that it actually is a skill that can be learned. It's a skill that can be cultivated. And the usual way of cultivating it in these ancient traditions was through meditation. People would spend some time, sometimes a lot, sometimes a little, each day doing some meditations. And the word meditation is just a translation of a word that originally meant cultivation. So it was just like you cultivate your garden or cultivate a fields. And that gives a flavour of what meditation's about. In other words, just like when you cultivate a garden, you don't expect instant results. You just have to do it and hope, really. So with meditation, you just have to do it and hope. In other words, meditation might not feel very good. You know, you might sit there for 20 minutes a day in silence and your mind is wandering all over the place and you think, oh, I can't do this. This is so stupid. Oh, I don't know. Why am I wasting my time? But if you do that regularly each day, take a bit of quiet time each day, then, like with cultivating a garden, things begin to grow and you begin to notice things. And this is what happens over an 8-week program that we teach for people. They come to classes 2 hours a week for 8 weeks, and everybody goes through a phase pretty much of going, oh, this is so boring, this is so useless. But by the end, something in the garden has grown. So that gives a bit of a flavour of it, but it started with these ancient Buddhist meditations, but then the Stoics, the Greeks, also took up a sort of daily practice of paying attention, especially the Stoics. Seneca talks about this, Marcus Aurelius talk about this, the nature of focusing every day on something that would bring you closer to the actuality of life. The Stoics, and they really believed you had to focus on nature, for example, and what they meant by that, to really know that we live and then we die. And so don't get above your station, they would say. Watch out for your reputation, because, you know, one day you're not going to be here anymore. Your reputation might live for a while with other people, but they're going to go soon as well. So not very bright and happy, but that's the Stoics for you. But they practiced a daily practice of meditation, of attention, of cultivating attention. And it was probably their influence that influenced the Desert Fathers in the early Christian church, who went out to seek God in the desert and then settled down 200 or 300 years in monastic communities where they would practice as well this meditation. And so this idea of cultivating silence or cultivating attentive presence then was in the Buddhist tradition, in the Christian tradition, and it's been in faith traditions and kept alive in faith traditions for 2,500 years in this way. And as you know, although we're getting more secular in the West, attendance at cathedrals and sacred spaces and retreat centres is actually going up. People are losing interest in something that I spend quite a lot of my time doing, sort of organised religion in the Anglican and the United Reformed Church. People seem to be not so much interested in that, but very interested in going on pilgrimage or going to retreats and so on. So we have to ask, well, how did mindfulness end up to be a secular practice that the National Health Service could use? Well, okay, probably you wouldn't get Buddhism taught in an NHS. But about 3 or 4 decades ago, there was a guy called Jon Kabat-Zinn who decided to take all his experience of as a yoga teacher in Korean Zen and in insight meditation and develop an 8-week program which stripped out all the sort of the more contemplative traditional language, but taught these attention, paying attention without judgment, moment by moment, taught these core practices in an 8-week program in the heart of a modern hospital with people whose doctors had given up on them. There were people with chronic pain, they'd had operations and accidents, and their pain medication had stopped working, or they couldn't have another bit of surgery because the spine wouldn't take it. And there wasn't anything more the doctor could do, so Kabat-Zinn said, okay, well, send them to my stress clinic. And in his stress clinic, he taught mindfulness for 8 weeks and got remarkable results. In those days, the major treatment for pain was pain medication, but also if you went to a psychologist, there were distraction techniques, how to distract yourself away from your body. And what Kabat-Zinn was doing was actually bringing people back to their body. And it's worth asking then, why could it be the case that increasing people's awareness of their body would be useful if they were in pain? Because you would think that's a stupid thing to do. But what Kabat-Zinn had realized from his own experience and from talking with many of his patients, that when people suffer from chronic pain, actually the pain is only one element of their suffering. There is pain, but there's lots of thoughts about the pain, or thoughts about life, like my pain is killing me, I won't enjoy life again, there's nothing I can do about it, I wish I didn't have this pain, I can't, you know, I won't enjoy my children, and so on. And those thoughts, and indeed the sensations of pain themselves, create emotions of frustration and helplessness and anger. And what happens not very slowly after you get this chronic pain is you end up with intense sensations and the thoughts and feelings about the pain becoming fused together like a limpet on a rock. They become inseparable, and it's no longer possible to distinguish between the sensations of pain and the thoughts and the feelings about it. And that happens automatically. It's not anybody's fault. It just happens. But when you bring awareness to something, awareness dissolves the automatic. Automatic habits, when you bring awareness to them, these things begin to uncouple. So you begin to see, that's a thought. That's not the pain. That's a thought about the pain. And that's not pain. That's a feeling about the pain. And there's the pain there. And it's coming and going, maybe. And what he found was that people at the end of the program still had sensations in their body, but somehow they didn't fill the whole space of their lives. The pain was like in a corner of the room instead of in the whole room, dominating everything, because of this way of uncoupling things. And he was a scientist as well, a molecular biologist by training, and published his early papers in the 1980s, very radical approach, getting people to focus towards themselves, to the source of their fear, in a sense. And when some colleagues of myself and I came to say, could we use this technique in a mental health setting for repeated recurrent depression, we went to see Kabat-Zinn to ask if he felt that with some modifications, the 8-week program could be useful for people who were, it's not now pain fusing with things, but in depression, similar thing. You get depressed, and that bit of sadness begins to get linked with thoughts about oneself, usually self-critical, self-denigrating thoughts like I'm useless, I'm weak, I'm stupid, I don't deserve my place on the planet, nobody loves me, all my friends are sick of me. Depression, we know, starts now between 13 and 15 years of age. So by the age of 18, 50% of people who are ever going to get depressed in their life have already been depressed at least once. By the age of 24, 75% of people who are ever going to get depressed have been depressed once. So depression in adult life tends to be a reactivation of a previous episode. And if the first episode starts when you're a teenager at school, then you can imagine the sort of feelings that are going to revisit you later on if it all comes back. Because when you're first depressed, you're going to feel helpless and bullied and out of sorts and friendless and abandoned and inadequate because you're still only 13 or 14 years old. And we all feel a bit like that when we're 13 or 14. But then what happens when you're in your 20s or 30s or 40s, when you get a little bit of mood, that mood reactivates all those collection of thoughts and behaviors you had as a teenager. So very rapidly, if you've been recurrently depressed, a little bit of mood then colours the whole thing. You can't see any more sort of reality. You just feel completely fed up and friendless and abandoned. So we said to Kabat-Zinn, do you think this sort of approach would work for depression? He thought it could. We developed something called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, did a randomized controlled trial, and found that it halved the rates of recurrent depression. And now there are several studies and meta-analyses, and it's in the NICE guidelines, and surprisingly, we found it worked even better if you had a longer history, more episodes, and a traumatic history as a child or an adolescent. So normally psychotherapy doesn't work so well if you've got a long history and traumatic childhood. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy seems to work even better if you have that sort of history. But that would explain why mindfulness is useful for clinical psychologists and nurses and therapists, but why has it become so popular in the outside world? And I think that's because this sense of distractibility isn't just confined to people that have, you know, big problems. It's a pretty universal problem that we find ourselves, our minds scattered a bit. And when people practice mindfulness, it tends to bring things together. So maybe we could just do 3 or 4 minutes of mindfulness, and you can just experiment with seeing that it's not very bizarre, it's really very, very simple. So if you just put both feet on the floor, if they'll reach, so that you can feel your feet on the floor, and then if you like, you can just feel the back being supported by the back of the chair, or you can come away from the back of the chair if it feels comfortable to you. And letting the eyes close or just lowering your gaze. And the first thing we're going to do is just to notice the sense of the contact with the floor. So the soles of the feet, the bottoms of the feet. And we're not looking for anything amazing to happen, we're just allowing the spotlight of attention to be down in the feet. And when your attention gets there, seeing what you notice. There may be buzzing or tingling, heat or coldness. And then bringing that same quality of attention to your hands, where they make contact with your lap or your thigh. And then to the backs of the legs where they're making contact with the chair. And then maybe at a certain point, bringing that same spotlight of attention to the lower abdomen, where there may be sensations created by the breath as it breathes in and as it breathes out. And seeing if it's possible to allow the attention to rest lightly down in the lower abdomen, the rising of the in-breath, and the falling away of the out-breath. Now, very often when we do this, we can follow 2 or 3 breaths, and then the mind gets a bit bored and starts reminding us of things we meant to do, or so if your mind wanders when this happens, then it's not a mistake. That's what minds do. Just notice where the mind went. And then very slowly and very gently escorting your attention back to the breath. So we're breathing without trying to control the breath, just knowing the sensations of the breath. and then expanding this attention to the body as a whole sitting here. So allowing yourself to notice this sitting. Feet on the floor, the body on the chair. This body just as it is. And you just as you are. A sense of acceptance. When you're ready, just beginning to wiggle your fingers and toes and letting the eyes open if they've been closed. Okay. So in this way, we ask people to focus on one thing, just do one thing at a time, and then to notice the mind actually doesn't particularly want to focus on one thing. It goes, and then you shepherd it back, and then it goes again, and then you shepherd it back. And like a shepherd, there's no point shouting at the mind, because it'll do it anyway. So, you know, and the shepherd presumably doesn't shout at his sheep. You know, you shepherd the mind back, then it goes again, and you shepherd the mind back. So it's what meditation is. This is the cultivation. It's not about clearing the mind. It's not about getting rid of thoughts. You need the thoughts. You need the mind wandering, because that's the practice. Your mind will wander, and then we shepherd it back. And the mind will wander, and we shepherd it back. So the going away, the coming back, this movement is what the mindfulness is about. If you meditate for 10 minutes, you may get 100 distractions. If you meditate for half an hour, 1,000 distractions, you know. But that's meditation. It's not hoping that you can focus on the breath for half an hour and gritting your teeth and thinking, oh, my mind's gone again. It's just about noticing it's going, standing back and noticing its patterns like clouds in the sky. And in this way, the thoughts begin to float away from the feelings. The feelings and the thoughts and the body sensations and the physical sense of yourself is able to be seen clearly, but differently from the thoughts about the physical. Yeah. But of course we're distracted. We try to, and there's just two things I want to say before we close, in a sort of explanation of why I think people are coming to mindfulness classes if they have no problems, apparently, just to increase their well-being. Because it's been found that the more distracted people are, the lower their well-being. And the more multitasking we do, the lower our well-being. But we often try to multitask, and if you notice, mindfulness teaches us to single task. I once was discussing multitasking with a Dutch colleague, and he said, oh, I've got a really good way of demonstrating something about multitasking. He said, most of us actually can't multitask. What we do is multi-switch. Yeah? So we actually switch rapidly between one task and another. And we think we're multitasking because we're quite good at parking that while we do this and then coming back. But we don't realize the consequences of doing that. And this person said, here's a really good way of showing the consequences. And so... It's okay, don't worry. How long does it take to spell the word multitasking? M-U-L-T-I-T-A-S-K-I-N-G. So if I can just take my watch and ask you to spell the word multitasking, and put your hand up when you finish spelling. Do it as fast as you can, starting now. Okay, so at least 50% of your hands went up after about 3.5-4 seconds. Okay, now there are 12 letters in the word multitasking. So I just want you to count from 1 to 12 as fast as you can, starting now. Oh, right, 3 seconds, no problem. Okay, so you can spell multitasking and count from 1 to 12 in 4 plus 3, 7 seconds, yeah? So now I want you to do a very simple task. I want you to go M1, U2, L3, T4, okay? And then put your hand up when you've finished, starting now. I'll wait for 50% of hands to go up. 20. Do you want me to put you out? Okay, right, let's stop there then. Good, about 50% went up in about 25 seconds. So 7 seconds to do the two tasks individually, about a factor of what? 3 or 4 longer just to do that switching. And you could actually calculate, that's called the switching cost. You can Google it if you like, if you're into psychology. Google switching cost. Usually, switching costs experiments are sort of laboratory tasks where you measure the thing in milliseconds. But that's a very good example because you're switching 12 times. And I don't know whether you noticed, but you had to throw M, then you had to think one, then you had to think, oh, where was I? You. And the where was I is quite noticeable there, wasn't it? Also, psychologists also talk about inhibition of return. When you do one task, when you attend to one thing, you have to suppress the alternative. But if you're then going to the alternative, it takes time to get rid of that suppression to get back on. So you're actually doing a lot of inhibition. Oh, no thank you. Oh, yeah. And that takes time. And a lot of time, as we see. But when we're going around our daily lives, sort of, you know, perhaps writing a document and then an email comes in and you just answer that email because you can. And then you get back to your document. And then the email, of course, because you've answered it, the person responds to you again and so you answer that. And then you do that. Nobody's standing behind you to say, you know, if you just finished that document, you'd have got it done in 10 minutes. And if you'd done the emails, you'd have got those done in 3 minutes, 13 minutes. But it's taken you 25 minutes to do both. Yeah. And it's very exhausting. So at the end of that document and at the end of emails, you're really tired. And that's when you press the delete key instead of the save key, just because you noticed. Yeah. So distraction, one thing. Now, what mindfulness teaches is how to single task. It doesn't say you have to single task, you know, and if you multitask, then you're a bad person. It just wakes you up occasionally to, oh, actually, I'm doing this switching, and for this one, I don't have to. So I can just finish that thing and then do that rather than try to be clever about it. And mindfulness gives you a sense of reminder about that. And I think that's one reason, because people come to a mindfulness class and they find, like, busy teachers who do mindfulness, for example, say afterwards they feel like they get more time in the day. Now, their head teacher isn't giving them any less responsibilities. In fact, they're meditating, so they've got more to do in the day. But they feel like they've got more time because spaces are opening up. And I think that's because they're not doing so much multitasking, they're actually getting their 25 seconds down to 7 seconds again, a little bit. And that releases more time than it takes to meditate each day. So people say, I haven't got time to meditate. Well, there is more time. But I think there's another reason why mindfulness is quite attractive for people who don't have any sort of depression or physical problems. And I think that's because Sally mentioned this about anxiety and fear and how easily triggered our fight and flight mechanism is. You know, the amygdala is pretty much, in many people, like stuck in the on position. Like we just overreact to things. And we know that as people learn mindfulness, that begins to calm down. There's actually brain changes that the amygdala changes both structurally and functionally over an 8-week mindfulness course. But I think it's not just the trigger happy amygdala. I think it's that normally when the amygdala fires, In animals, of course, when the amygdala fires, then it just makes the animal flee, perhaps like a gazelle running from a lion. But you know what happens when a lion has dragged off one of the herd? The gazelles go back to grazing. It switches back off again. It's a remarkable thing to see that one of the gazelles has been taken by the lion and the gazelles go back to grazing after 5 minutes. What on earth can that be about? Don't they know that the lion will be back? Do they not understand? I mean, we could, if we just put a human module in their brain, they could worry about it. Yeah? And they would also have a memory like humans do. They, you know, we could produce a human gazelle that actually would think, oh my gosh, that's the third time this month. And it might be me next time. Yeah? In other words, humans have the ability to think outside the box, to imagine futures. And not only that, we can imagine what might have happened. And actually, there's hardly, well, there's many things that can happen that happen to us. I knew somebody once who was in an accident, a car accident, where nobody was hurt, but who was tortured by the idea that if I had been killed, what would have happened to my children? If I'd been killed, what would have happened to my children? And that was far more stressful than actually the memory of the accident. So our human capacity to think and imagine things was actually causing more stress. And so I think one of the things, this business about uncoupling, so that people after mindfulness both see the fear but enable it to subside, more like gazelle, and they then see the worry and the what might have happened, but they see that like a cloud in the sky, so they don't connect, and that enables people to have more spaciousness in their lives. Anyway, that's just a little bit of flavour of what mindfulness is, about where it came from, of how it went out of the monasteries and came into the sort of secular world, about how it's used in the health service and seems to be having some good effects, but how it's escaped even from the clinic, and why I think some people are taking to it, because it helps to deal, I think, with a frazzled life that most of us lead. And although it might have just a small effect, sometimes small effects can have big consequences. Thank you very much indeed.
Wow, that was really, really interesting, and I hope we're all being inspired by that. Very much. Is there a few minutes for questioning?
How do you actually determine who is good at it?
That's a very good question.
Who is legitimate?
Yeah. Okay. So usually, if you look on a mindfulness teacher's website, you can see what training they've done. And if you look at whether they endorse what the UK mindfulness teachers guidelines, and they should say that I go by that, and that actually you can guarantee they'll be supervised, they've been properly trained, because that's one thing. If you go on to the Mental Health Foundation's website, bemindful.co.uk, that's a Mental Health Foundation run that website, and there's a Google map of where there's mindfulness teachers, and they will only allow people to register on that website if they practice according to that. One of the big training centres is in Bangor in North Wales, another in Oxford, another in Exeter, but there are now many other training centres, and they all speak to each other and sort of have guidelines. But that's the thing to do, to check that out.
I have a sense that mindfulness is sort of very popular with the middle classes, the sort of chattering classes. Is there any evidence that it's been successful across the piece in terms of the population?
Yeah, you're quite right that because it started in the sort of the health service type of setting. But that's true. But there's now a lot of mindfulness work in prisons, for example, where the people are very disadvantaged. Amongst homeless projects, St Mungo's has got a mindfulness both for the staff and the people who register there. There are work in communities. There's work in Oxford, actually, with groups of mums who are expecting a baby who have had their previous children taken into care often the dads are in prison, if the dads are around at all. And they've all in these cases, when they've been evaluated, they've been found very useful. So the police are using it a lot now in their training, and we hope to start training prison officers with it very soon. So I think it's across the board. It does have that sort of chattering class feel about it, because those are sort of newspapers and magazines that feature it. But we're very, very keen that, and we have several accessibility projects that target specific groups in this way.
Thank you.
I think that women are supposed to be good at multitasking.
Yeah.
And I've always prided myself on this. I clearly have a lot of things to unlearn.
Well, you don't unlearn all of it, because you can multitask when one of the tasks has become automatic. Then you can layer tasks, right? So, for example, when you learnt to drive, right, you probably found, well, I certainly did, that when you were asked to change gear, you would have to look down at the gear stick to see where the gear was. I'd learnt to drive on my mother's Minor 1000, and the gear stick was very long and had a little Bakelite knob at the end where the 1, 2, 3, 4 had long since rubbed off. And you could do this to the gear stick even without pressing the clutch. So you had to put your foot down the clutch and then experiment where the gear was. And this took a lot of my attention away from the road. But eventually I learned to drive on my mother's car, and I was very good at manipulating her gear stick. And because it became automatic, I could then do other things as well. So multitasking when one of the tasks has become automatic is great. But when two tasks need the same global workspace in the brain, in the mind, then we have a capacity problem. And the mind will tend to prioritize one over the other. And that's where it's most switching. So like the counting, you know, thing example is it needs the same thing, and you have to switch, and then you have a problem. Yeah. So don't give it up quite yet.
When you started, you said mindfulness is particularly good with depression. Is that where its main use is?
Its main use in the National Health Service is for depression. It's also used as part of a complex treatment for borderline personality disorder called dialectical behavior therapy, where mindfulness is one of the skills training for people whose emotions are up and down, who cut themselves, who have drug problems, relationship problems. But they're not as common as depression. It's one in five of us at some point will get depressed, clinically depressed in our lives. And the problem is that once you've been depressed twice, it tends to come back. So it is one of the commonest uses of mindfulness and one of the commonest problems to use it within the mental health setting. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I asked a question because my wife had Parkinson's for 13 years. And probably 6 years ago, she was recommended to do mindfulness, which she really tried hard at. Mm. She wasn't depressed, and really, it worried her rather than helped her, and she just couldn't get into it and had to stop. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
I'm not sure why it was therefore recommended because of Parkinson's.
Well, I mean, this is part of the problem, that once mindfulness has got out there, it tends to be recommended for everything. It's a default option. People get a bit trigger happy in recommending it. And it's true to say that 19 out of 20 people who do mindfulness find it useful for something. But 1 in 20 don't find it useful. Actually, if they persist, it makes them feel worse. So you have to look at how much potential difficulty do you get into compared with the 19 people who feel better or a little better, and then a few people who feel much, much better. But it's not guaranteed. That's why I started by saying that. Yeah. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you very much for that. That was fascinating. I'm wondering if Parkinson's people would benefit or do benefit particularly from mindfulness, because so much of what we do that used to be natural is no longer natural to us.
Yeah.
And so therefore anything that helps us focus on things would enable us to do more. I certainly think I would benefit from that.
Yeah, well, I think it is useful, and I think that there are one or two studies of mindfulness in Parkinson's disease, as you may know, and one study of brain, sort of looking at brain function, which was very interesting, though they didn't look at clinical outcomes as well as the brain function. They just found changes in the brain. Others have looked at clinical and found it sort of reduces depression, increases well-being. There's another study that Tai Chi was very good. So movement, just slow movement, sort of balletic movements were very helpful. And the interesting thing about the Tai Chi was they compared it in that study, quite a big study, to resistance training, you know, sort of gymnasium type training, and to another form of movement as well. So that there seemed to be something about the Tai Chi which was of unique benefit there. And as you know, Tai Chi comes from the same tradition, the yoga tradition of the mindfulness tradition, and we use yoga, a bit of yoga, in the 8-week program, for example. So I think the movement component of that is very useful, but also the mindfulness component, this uncoupling with the frustration with any condition that comes, the sense of, I recognize this, and all the sort of the satellite thoughts that come off it as thoughts rather than as reality. Yeah. Thank you.
Hello. A number of people have told me that they've given up mindfulness because it's boring, and you did mention that in your talk.
Yeah.
At the same time, I'm aware of a lot of people, like sports people, who use creative visualization as part of their training for doing things in their mind helps them do things in reality.
Yeah.
I wonder if it would be a better use of our time when we're meditating to use creative visualization to help us over some of our problems and rather than just focusing on the breath.
Well, I'm sure that there's all sorts of different ways in, and different people will find different things helpful at different times in their life. And I think that there's two aspects about visualization. One is it can take you to interesting places, and for sports people, interesting possibilities. And we know that if a pianist actually imagines playing the piano or playing a piece, they get some benefit, much more than not imagining it, almost equivalent to rehearsing that piece. Yeah. They imagine it as a cognitive rehearsal. So those, we know that those are useful, and sports people have used that. One of the things about mindfulness, it takes away the sense of trying to have a goal. That's why it's boring, actually, because mostly we work to achieve something. Whereas this rather boring cultivation, like gardening that I mentioned earlier, can seem very boring, but in what you're doing is effectively setting up a laboratory in which you are seeing more clearly the sort of things that get you snagged in your daily life, the sort of little irritations and frustrations and so on. So when boredom comes, that's a real advantage, because you get to see boredom. Now, boredom is really interesting. So when you get bored, if you can actually sort of take a step back and go, now what's here in this boredom? And, I should be doing things, and what you can suddenly hear a voice in your head which sounds maybe like a parent's voice saying, come on, do something more useful with your time. And that's actually very, very interesting to see and to go, okay, I can see you, and I can see you, and goodbye. Rather than it lodging. So sometimes with a good teacher, you can be encouraged when you get bored to become interested in it, and then you begin to see all sorts of things, which releases a sense of the power that these rather undermining thoughts can have on us that sometimes have been around a long time. And that doesn't tend to happen with things that distract you, which might be good in other respects, like visualization or even running or doing exercise or whatever it is. I think that's the power of this. But it's not for everybody, and it's not for everybody all the time. But it's worth, I think, you know, examining for those who'd like to examine it. Yeah. Thank you.
It's really pulling up on what you said about multitasking and awareness. And I thought something, and then when you responded to that question, I want to say this. I often do repetitive tasks because I'm limited in what I can do. Frequently, when I do that, I at the same time do something like listen to the radio or listen to a talking book. And I was wondering, after you spoke, well, hang on, should I just, you know, well, how should I be with this? And then when you said about it's all right with repetitive tasks, but then I'm thinking, well, I'm not paying attention to the ironing, see. Mm-hmm. I just wondered how you respond to that.
Okay, so this is a good example of where you can do things because you're layering them. You know, something takes up your mind and something takes up your hand, and that's fine. And I don't want to discourage you from doing the ironing. So otherwise you might have a very good excuse. He told me I didn't do it. So, but sometimes if you're doing a mindfulness class, the teacher might say, just this week, once a day, focus on a routine activity and really pay attention to it. And the purpose of that is just for maybe 5 minutes or when you're brushing your teeth or something, is just to notice that that's another moment. Because often when we're away in our heads, life flies by. Because, you know, we put the television on, or we put the radio on, or we put a podcast on, or we someone, and we so fill our lives that actually, at the end of the day, sometimes it's gone. So sometimes just by spending maybe 2 minutes ironing and only ironing before you put the podcast on, or 2 minutes eating and only eating before you put John Humphreys on. He's going anyway, isn't he, John Humphreys? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so there's a sense of just doing something for its own sake, just as an experiment, to taste the food, to smell the iron, and to smell the clothes that are getting burnt, whatever it happens to be, and to take the full moment just a few times a day is quite recommended. But that doesn't mean that, you know, you're not allowed to put a podcast on when you're ironing. It's all sorts of possibilities, yeah.